You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Negebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Negebauer, and today is Friday, April 3rd, 2020. Today, we have two guests on the podcast, April Grondin, who is a commercial fisherman, and Joseph Bogard, who is the executive director of Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition. And today, we are going to be talking about probably the hottest issue. We are going to be talking about the Columbia Snake River salmon and associated dams. And this is in the news. I'm sure you've heard about it if you're following the plight of our southern resident killer whales. This has been an issue that's been going on for a really long time, but now our southern resident killer whales are sort of at the heart of this issue. But there are a lot of other things that are going on. There are farmers, barge transportation, there's fishermen, tribes, everyone else out there in the ecosystem. So there's a lot to talk about. There was, about a month ago, a draft environmental impact statement that was released. It is thousands of pages long. We are going to be talking about that. We're going to be breaking it down and making it easy for you to comment, to get engaged, and to be informed about this issue. So without further ado, I'll welcome our guests. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast. Today we are joined by Amy Grondin and Joseph Bogard. Amy Grondin is a commercial fisherman. She fishes for wild salmon off the coast of Washington in southeast Alaska. When not on the water, she works as a commercial fishing and outreach specialist with the Sustainable Food Systems as a Sustainable Food Systems consultant. Amy is on the board of Organic Seed Alliance, as well as being a member of Slow Food, the Chef's Collaborative, and Community Fisheries Network. She advocates for sustainable and local regional food systems and has great concern for sustainability of our ocean research sources. And Joseph Bogard is the executive director of Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition. Thank you guys so much for joining me today. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Doing great, Whitney. Thanks for having us.
So, Joseph, tell us a little bit about SOS and the work that you guys do.
So, the Save Our Wild Salmon Coalition, or SOS, is a we've been around almost 30 years. We developed or coalesced, if you will, in the early 1990s in response to the first salmon listings that occurred under the Endangered Species Act that occurred anywhere in the country. That was Snake River sockeye. And that was the first of what's now 13 populations of salmon and steelhead in the Columbia Basin that are officially listed as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act. And notably, all four remaining Snake River salmon and steelhead populations are on that list. And what happened in the early 90s when this listing occurred is that a number of sort of diverse salmon interests, commercial fishing people, sport fishing people, conservationists, got together and started talking with each other and realizing if we don't start working together, we're going to be fighting over the last fish. And the coalition came together, and we focus on our common ground. We're focused on the Columbia Basin salmon restoration efforts. The Columbia and Snake River Basin was once the most prolific, productive salmon drainage on the planet. It's not that any longer, unfortunately. And the two areas of sort of policy and advocacy where we really focus on is restoring and reconnecting healthy habitats, and ensuring that we manage the federal hydro system, the system of scores of dams throughout the system, in a manner that is more sustainable and balanced with regards to salmon resources that also rely on this landscape.
And Amy, can you describe a little bit about how you fish and where you fish and how you've personally been impacted by the salmon that Joseph is talking about?
Yeah, sure. I started working on boats in Alaska, salmon buying boats called tenders in 1991 or 93. I can never remember. I shouldn't think I would. But after doing that, my husband and I started running our own buyer's boats and got to know the fishing industry really well in Alaska. After about 15 years of doing that, we decided that we were tired of managing a crew and thought that we should try out fishing as well. So we got into the troll fishery, which is a hook and line fishery where you catch each salmon one at a time. So we've been doing that for the last 11 years. We start in May and June off the coast of Washington, and then we move north to Alaska, working out of the Sitka area for the fishing season in Alaska. So, it's been really interesting that it's kind of one of those perfect storm situations where you see climate change, if you're a believer, which I am, and the habitat impacts that we've made on land colliding together to make it really hard for salmon to survive. And I'm a firm believer that we have a really good management system now of our commercial salmon fisheries. It wasn't always the case, but we've tried to learn from our mistakes, and we work really hard with researchers and fishermen and other stakeholders to make sure that we're not taking the last fish, because we all want to have that resource out there for us. And it hasn't been easy in the face of large habitat destruction, such as having the dam. So when they went in, I don't think people realized the impact they would have. And over the years, it's been pretty devastating. So we just need to get some balance back. And we can talk more about that in a bit.
And what is the significance of the Columbia Basin for people like you?
For me, the Columbia Basin, Joseph, you could, I think you gave the fact earlier, but it was one of the largest, if not the largest, salmon producing areas in the world. Salmon leave the Columbia River or any of their natal streams that they come from, whether it's Alaska or California or anywhere, even, you know, Russia. And they swim out into the ocean to do their growing and eating and all the things they do before they return to their streams to breed the next generation. So those fish mix and swim, and nobody really knows where they go once they leave that river. But tag samples and different things have shown that a lot of the fish that are caught in Alaska actually originated from from the Columbia River. And if you check tags down here, you'll see that some of those fish from other regions are caught in Washington. So it's one great big mix of delicious hard swimming salmon out there that are feeding the marine feed web while they're doing their job at sea. And then when they come in, they're feeding people like my husband and I and the people we sell our fish to. So having the Columbia River be healthy and prosperous and producing salmon is incredibly important, not just to us, but to orcas and all the other fisheries and people that make a living or admire salmon or like to catch one anywhere in the Pacific Ocean.
Joseph,
the other point to add is the role that salmon historically have played in delivering nutrients to the not just the people, but the ecosystems, the fish and wildlife resources, and the landscape itself in the Columbia Basin. Historically, you know, the basin would see 10 to 16 million fish return every year, moving up the main stem, you know, mouth of Columbia, the Columbia, into all its tributaries. And each one of those fish is a fertilizer bag, effectively, that's feeding, you know, again, historically feeding bears, wolves, coyotes, bald eagles, and a whole, you know, over 100 other animals have been identified as beneficiaries of salmon. And, you know, those benefits have been lost in recent decades as these populations have declined, largely as a result of the habitat destruction on the freshwater side, where, you know, we've constructed so many dams and segmented this habitat and you know, created warm water reservoirs where there's a lot of predation by and oftentimes invasive species and that sort of thing. And as I think Amy put it well, the work that many of us are involved in restoring these populations to self-sustaining levels that deliver benefits to people and ecosystems, including, of course, southern resident orcas, is about restoring balance. The system is terribly out of balance now. We've got to work together with others in the region to figure out how to restore that balance in a way that moves us all forward together.
I'm almost imagining like a two-way highway that is the Columbia River, with salmon going, back and forth and delivering all these precious nutrients and services for everyone. So what happened? You mentioned historically that there was this habitat destruction. Can you describe a little bit about the dams, why they were made, and how they are impeding the fish's migration?
Sure. There's probably 400 or more dams in the Columbia Basin today, all different kinds. They basically have been built over the last century, certainly a major undertaking of the 20th century, the last century's technology. And, dams were built for a number of different reasons: energy production, water storage, flood control, and transportation, barge transportation, flat water transportation. The dams provide services, and with them come costs. And in some cases, I think increasingly what we're finding today, as we move out of last century and into the new century, those costs have increased in various ways. And I think it's a good thing that people are reassessing the impact and costs and benefits of many of these dams. And in some cases, people are making decisions to pull them out because they realize that their costs exceed or in some cases far exceed the benefits they deliver. And there's alternatives available today. One of the places where this conversation has been particularly focused and challenging in the Pacific Northwest is on the Lower Snake River in Southeast Washington. There's four dams that were built in the Lower Snake River in the 1960s and 70s. Immediately after their completion, salmon populations on that, the biggest tributary of the Columbia River, plummeted by 90%, and they've never recovered. We lost Snake River coho in the 1980s. They went extinct. And the steelhead, spring, summer Chinook, fall Chinook, and sockeye are holding on as best they can, but they won't be able to survive. The science has been strong and consistent over the last couple decades that we're going to need to make some big changes in order to protect them and recover them and the benefits they deliver to people and ecosystems. If in order to do that, of course, the conversation is really focused since the late 90s on their removal. And that conversation right now, of course, is in full swing in the region today as the federal government and the region grapple with how we're going to move forward. We've spent $17 billion over the last 25 years in the Columbia Basin, much of it in the Snake River system, in efforts to recover salmon, steelhead populations, and we haven't recovered a single population despite those expenditures. I think there's a growing number of people in the region realizing it's time to think about new approaches, and we've got to be able to spend our money wisely and for a greater return on investment, because what we're doing now, not only is it illegal, but it's unsustainable and unaffordable, and it can't continue.
What is it specifically about these dams that is so harmful for fish?
These dams do a number of things. They basically segmented a free-flowing river into a series of warm water reservoirs. salmon and steelhead populations, when their young juveniles headed out towards the ocean and as adults returning, need cool waters. And one of the consequences of having constructed these dams is that they absorb a lot of solar radiation in the spring and summer months, and their temperatures far exceed often in the summertime for weeks on end. They exceed the comfort zone, if you will, of salmon and steelhead, to the point where these fish have to use more energy, to the point where they're more susceptible to disease. And at some points, in some cases, if folks remember in 2015, we had low water year and high temperatures, and we lost hundreds of thousands of returning adult salmon to the Columbia and Snake Rivers because of the reservoirs, the water temperatures in the reservoirs. So temperatures is one thing. For the smolts, the young juvenile fish that are trying to get out to the ocean, typically in the spring and summer months, this journey that used to take a couple of weeks from central Idaho now takes more than a month, maybe 2 months. These fish used to get pushed out to the ocean quickly in a current of cold water. Now they have to, they hit these reservoirs. The waters are warmer. That's not good for them. And then they have to find their way. They have to swim through these reservoirs, pass through each of 8 dams before reaching the ocean. By the time they get there, if they get there, their energy resources are depleted, and their survival levels are much lower than they would have been otherwise. But important to remember, 50 to 70% of those young fish coming out of Idaho never arrive at the ocean because they get they are killed by the dams, they're killed in the reservoirs, they're eaten by predators. The dams for Snake River fish are the single most greatest cause of human mortality anywhere in their life cycle. And so if we're gonna protect and restore these populations and their benefits to people and ecosystems, we're gonna have to take those impacts head on. And again, the scientists have told us for several decades now, restoring the Lower Snake River is key to their survival and their recovery.
Amy, if a free-flowing river is going to be so beneficial to you and to everyone else out there that are dependent on salmon, why is this issue so controversial?
Boy, you know, it goes back to when those last four Snake River dams were put in. It's like, actually, you know, there's a little piece I would like to read, a paragraph that's from a report from the State of Washington Department of Fisheries. It's an annual report from 1949. This is back before they had the W, the wildlife in their name, before they were WDFW. So it says here, this policy of water development, the department maintains, is not in the best interest of the overall economy of the state. Salmon must be protected from the type of unilateral thinking that would harm one major industry to benefit another. Long-range planning, in which federal and state agencies work together cooperatively to the end that fisheries or any other industry is not discriminated against, is a fairer method of approach. So this was written in 1949 as a warning and advisory from the Washington State Department of Fisheries to the federal agencies that were discussing putting in the dam, saying that the writing was already on the wall. They could see that this was not going to work. So at that point, when the dams went in, nobody really realized that, they did know they would offer transportation, but they didn't realize the water benefits from the irrigation that they would be able to get from it. And as such, our farmers that produce the food that we need, the food that goes with my salmon to make it a meal, like I need farmers doing their job while I do my job so we can all eat. But they've really come to rely, some of them, on that water. And what we need to do is figure out how to get irrigation for those farmers that need it and make it a fair playing field again, because the result of those dams going in meant that fisheries failed on the coast while the farming industry on the east side of the state got to thrive. And it was just what they said in this report about unilateral thinking and giving an advantage to one industry over the other when we need all these things that we can produce as food to eat in our state and for everyone else. So for me, I think that's one of the biggest issues is we created a system that wasn't there. People have become to depend on it and rely on it, no fault of their own. But now we need to figure out how to get the playing field even again for salmon, orca, fishermen, anybody who likes to use that water resource that's the river. And my goal is not to put farmers out of business because I admire and appreciate them because I know the hard work of working outside in nature against all odds to produce food. And it's a way of thinking. It's a lifestyle. It's something that just I you can't put value on. Is this you can't create food the way that we do as farmers and fishermen. It's just big scale industry will have you think that they can handle it, but what we really need is a regional food system, and that's a lot of what we're seeing right now with COVID-19 is that, like, we're depending more and more, this aha moment, that regional food systems are so important, and we need to take care of all aspects of that, wherever it comes from. Joseph mentioned that we had spent $19 billion with a B on trying to restore these salmon runs. That money would have been so much more wisely spent on trying to figure out how to help farmers with transportation in ways that don't impact our oceans and our coast and the lives of salmon that are so important in the marine food web, like I said, not just for us, but for every other creature in that ocean, orca down to the smallest things. That, you know, they all are interdependent, just like we are interdependent on them. So I think I'll stop for a minute. I think I'm starting to ramble, and we can refocus.
Well, part of those billions of dollars that you mentioned for study are part of this recent draft environmental impact statement, which was just released about a month ago, and now it is open for public comment. Joseph, what are your thoughts on this report?
Whitney, the report, I'll give a little bit of background. The federal government, since the Endangered Species Act listings started piling up in the early 90s, has been required to develop plans in order to demonstrate how operations of the hydro system were going to occur in a way that wouldn't put the fish further at risk. They've issued, the federal government has issued five plans over the last, 20 plus years. All of them have been ruled illegal and inadequate, and they've been ordered in a sequence to issue new plans. We're in the latest iteration of that merry-go-round and cycle of litigation. In 2016, the federal government's latest plan was ruled illegal. The court ordered a new plan, and it ordered a full comprehensive environmental review of recovery alternatives to accompany the development of that plan, which, sounds like a sensible thing to do. What are our options for recovery? What are the costs and benefits and trade-offs? And how do we move forward? One of the options that the court ordered was a full and fair analysis of restoring the Lower Snake River by removing its dams. Which again is something the scientists have said is essential if we're going to protect these fish from extinction, and is especially true in an era of climate change. So the draft environmental impact statement was just released in the end of February and is now sort of in the final days of a public comment period. I think the sort of summary statement is, the draft EIS is inadequate. It falls into the same old patterns of previous plans, and it offers up as its sort of recommendation or quote preferred alternative a fairly modest tweak on this status quo that has served so poorly the people and salmon of the region for the last 20 years. It does not recommend restoring the Lower Snake River. Instead, it recommends, it actually endorses a program that's already underway, which is a spill program. Spilling water over the dams in the spring and summer months is helpful to increasing the survival of young smolts as they head to the ocean. That said, the benefits are so modest that I think what scientists would describe is it buys some extra time for these fish, but it doesn't solve the problem and it certainly won't recover them. So if this draft plan becomes policy and is adopted, we're headed into a whole another cycle of litigation, which involves resources being spent in that arena, time being lost when we don't have it. There's great urgency to act, both for the sake of salmon populations, the sake of hungry orcas, which is an issue I want to sort of dive into a little bit more deeply, and for the human communities, tribal and non-tribal, that rely on these fish as well. I think to summarize for people listening, this draft plan coming from this federal government is not going to meet the needs of the salmon of the region, the orca of our region, and the people of our region. And, you know, the bottom line is, I think what's been amply demonstrated the last 25 years is the federal government, the federal agencies aren't in a position with their missions and authorities, even if they wanted to solve the problems here, to be able to solve the problems and put us on a path to salmon restoration and healthy communities, which is what we need in the region. What we need, it's important for people, the deadline is April 13, 2020. If you can get your comments into the agencies, that's fine. But what's more important is, I think at this stage, is to make sure that our elected officials are hearing from us. And that there's no deadline on that, but there's urgency to deliver those comments to Senator Murray, Senator Cantwell, Governor Inslee, your House members. The Northwest policymakers need to step in, work with stakeholders, utilities, conservation leaders, fishing people, and the sovereigns of the region, tribes, tribal people who have such a strong and deep and historic stake in the health of salmon and this region. The region has to work together and come up with a plan and an approach that restores balance, that invests in communities, make sure that we have healthy fishing and farming communities, along with healthy salmon and orca populations. And the one point I want to make, and then I'll conclude for at the moment, is the highlighting the critical importance of Snake River fish to southern resident orca. The Snake River Basin was once contributed about half of the spring Chinook population of the Columbia Basin. So it was highly productive of spring Chinook. Spring Chinook are those fish that gather at the mouth of the Columbia River in the winter months when there aren't many other fish available along the coast, because there aren't many other historically spring Chinook populations. There were some scattered across the coast, but the Columbia Basin and the Snake River Basin in particular was the greatest producer of spring Chinook, which was critical to orca at a key time of the year when other food resources weren't available. And so that's one of the important, I think, points that people, the scientists understand that, many people understand that. This plan doesn't acknowledge that at all, the plan from the federal government. And it's one of its many shortcomings that needs to be recognized and embraced as we move forward and think about the plan that we really need and the engagement by our elected officials that we really need to solve this for the long term.
In my research of this issue, I've also found that, the satellite tag data, the scat hormone data corroborates all of that information as well, that the southern resident killer whales are seen in that area off the mouth of the Columbia River when those spring Chinook are likely there, and that's likely what they're eating, and that is, a critical food source for them. They can't go weeks on end without eating. They're like us. We got to eat all the time. So, Amy, I'll ask you directly, do you feel that this draft environmental impact statement adequately addresses your needs and the needs of your community?
No, it does not at all. But I just I want to make a comment about what Joseph and you were just saying. It's just to make it more familiar for somebody, just like think about if somebody asked you not to eat for 2 months, and then are you going to survive? I mean, if someone said, okay, no more groceries for you for 2 months because you're traveling and you don't live here, so you don't get to eat it. It just is, it's kind of absurd that people poo-poo the fact that these orca are feeding at the mouth of the river, and they're, oh, no, they live in Puget Sound. They don't, you know, so... Anyway, just a side thought for me that gets me going. But the DEIS, no, it does not address my needs because it doesn't mention the financial impact or of the dams or any of this that it has on coastal communities, on tribal fishermen, on our treaty rights or any of those things. It really does not take a complete picture of everything that is involved and wrapped up in the importance of these dams. It's not just about water and farmers and irrigation and orca. You need to look at the whole thing. If we don't have a healthy, intact environment, we can't do any of those things that we as human like to do, like namely eat. So, or if we talk about enjoying the river or any of those kind of things, they're all important. But no, the DEIS is not looking at my needs at all. When those dams went in 40, 50 years ago, nobody was thinking about what it was going to do to the coast. Now they're really considering what's going to happen to the inland economy if those dams come out. And, you know, I just would ask people to think, you know, we need to restore this for everybody. And it's not just about making sure that one sector of the state is surviving and thriving. It's about making us all come out of this hole, that we are all in this together, and that we can help each other rather than be pitted against each other. I do not like this trend of reality TV pitting of farmers and fishermen against each other in the media. It shouldn't be that way. And it shouldn't be a choice about who gets to do their job or which animals get to live. I mean, we need to get our acts together, folks, and start thinking about this thing from a state level, from a federal level, locally. We need to get all our leaders together and talk this over, because as a concerned citizen, I can't personally breach those gaps in policy that are between the state and the federal agencies. I need help from my legislators to make that happen so we can restore this environment and make sure we move together in the future for the better.
One of the things that came out of Governor Inslee's Orca Task Force was a stakeholder process. And you know, I know a lot of people working on the Orca Task Force were trying to address a lot of these issues. And so I guess I asked both of you, how do you feel that process went? And what do you think Governor Inslee is going to do to respond to this information? So my understanding was that he was going to look at this stakeholder report and have that help shape his comments and his approach to this federal process. How do you think that's going? And amidst all of this crazy COVID-19 stuff, you know, is Inslee paying attention?
Why don't you go ahead, Joseph? Yeah, I can say a couple things. First, on the stakeholder process, that was something that Save Our Wild Salmon and Amy and many others were deeply involved in. I think that it's a 2-year process. Year one, which involved a series of interviews with stakeholders, almost 100, a draft, and then final report, and 3 public meetings in January. We thought that process. I think that process was important. It brought folks together. It got people who have long disagreed talking with each other, recognizing their disagreements, identifying the need for working together to move forward. And I think it was, you know, from my perspective, it was the first state-sanctioned conversation around Lower Snake River Dam removal that's occurred. And given the challenges facing communities and stakeholders on this set of issues for a long time, that was a really important step forward. And I think it went well. People got together, had civil conversations, didn't always agree, but it was a constructive conversation that I think demonstrated a demand or an interest on the part of people to move forward in new and different ways that bring everyone forward together. So that was good. You know, the state of Washington is in on behalf of the governor. I think they're working on those comments today, and I am confident they'll deliver comments to the federal government by the April 13th deadline, and we'll just have to see what those comments look like. You know, I'm pretty confident that they're focused on in taking seriously their Washington State's sort of perspective in this comment period. But you're absolutely right. The COVID, you know, circumstances, pandemic, which of course Washington State in the United States was ground zero, has been a as it should have been and it should be a primary focus of the governor. You know, so I think that we just have to acknowledge that, and it's important and right. And frankly, in my perspective, taking my hat off for a moment as the executive director's SOS, I feel like the governor's done a really good job demonstrating informed and effective leadership and responding, especially having been at ground zero. Having said that, you know, there is year two that is ahead, and I think I think it's important that the governor, especially as we get eventually past this COVID situation, that there's a need for the governor to continue to lean in, bring people together, work with other policymakers, work with tribal communities, fishing and farming communities to advance this conversation and help develop solutions that are going to move us all forward together. So, you know, governors and policymakers are, you know, used to juggling multiple balls at once. This is clearly an unprecedented situation that requires his full attention. But I think as we move forward, we're going to need to continue this conversation. And I hope the governor, you know, is able to help continue to move it forward and work with other, you know, other folks in the region to do that.
Amy, did you have any thoughts you wanted to add?
Yeah. No, I would echo with Joseph that we worked really, really hard to get the stakeholder process in place. It was months and over a year in trying to get this before our legislation in the state and to get them to vote on it, to get the money to fund this thing. And it was a huge accomplishment when it went through. It really took a lot of people working together, and it was really inspiring. And the process, as Joseph said, did bring people together, but it only brought together 10 people. So there were workshops that were associated with the stakeholders process, and they brought together 10 stakeholders from representing different, you know, whether it was river rafting, farmers, the energy sector, the tribes, and the commercial fishermen, and among other folks. But that was only 10 people, and it was a long, hard process for these people to figure out how to have these important conversations. We need to scale that up to include more communities and more people, because there was only one commercial fisherman who's very eloquent and a leader without any doubt, but we need more people to be having those conversations. So I would like to see Governor Inslee carry the stakeholder task force and just increase it so more of us can get together and talk, because I think it showed that those 10 people, when they got together, they could work together, and they saw what was really happening in each other's lives and where the push points were on, you know, making a living or not making a living, or what was important and where can we compromise and where can we come together and where do we need to, you know, we just get to know each other, because it's a big state. I mean, it's 9 hours easily from side to side. I don't know what farmers do on a daily basis, and I'm sure they don't know what I do, but we all need each other. So how do we get those people together to have these conversations? Because we can succeed. One point of frustration for me is that the stakeholder report that was delivered to the governor did not have a separate section on fisheries, whether that is a recreational or commercial. There is a section for agriculture, a section for transportation, rightly a section for tribes, and a section for orcas. But there wasn't, once again, the commercial fishing and the recreational fishing industry weren't represented in the report other than mentions in subsections of those other columns. And I would really ask that moving forward, that a big effort is made to include our economy on the coast and on the river, the people that catch or help other people catch fish for a living. In 1978, there were 3,041 fishing permits, the trollers, hook and line fishermen like myself, fishing the ocean of Washington State. In 2018, that number had dropped down to 102 permits. That's a 90% loss of economic opportunity in over from the 70s to now, and a huge hit to coastal economies. It's more than just me catching and selling a fish. Money that I make fishing, when I go back to Port Townsend, I put into my home community. It pays for my mortgage. Other people, it pays for their kids' college educations. I spend it on groceries, my car mechanic. If I'm not making that money, I'm not contributing to my local economy. And when we're fishing on the coast, we're buying groceries and we're buying fuel. We're just supporting local economies. Salmon give back to us in so many ways we don't even realize. And then not to mention whale-watching boats or those people that enjoy that. That's how they enjoy what salmon can offer them, is by having healthy orca pods out there, or gray whales that are, not gray whales, but let's stay with the orcas. But you know what I'm trying to say. It just, I get so passionate about it. I just, once again, I'm going to stop talking. But we need to make sure that everyone is represented in this process and the roles that we play and how we contribute to our local communities.
For listeners who want to get involved and they want to make comments and do the right thing and help everyone have more salmon, what's the best way that they can get involved, and are there resources that you can point them to on your website?
Sure. I'll make 2 points. I want to follow up on the conversation we've had and express appreciation, Whitney, for setting time aside for this. I think one message that hasn't come through clearly enough, it's implicit, but it needs to be stated clearly, is there is great urgency for action. This process, this conversation, this problem has been dragged out over a number of decades. And the place we find ourselves at now is the salmon facing extinction. Orca, southern resident orca, who've been plying the waters of the Northwest for hundreds of thousands of years, if not longer, along with the salmon of the Columbia Basin and across the coast, are facing extinction. There's just 72 members left in this orca community. We don't have much time here, and I think your listeners are well aware of that. Our elected officials need to be reminded of that, and the people of the region, we've got to come together. We don't have a lot of time to sort of continue to argue and you know, we need to follow the science, and we need to make decisions, and we need to act. And you know, there are options here that can work for everybody. But there isn't much time. So I think I just want to impress upon, I think Amy shares that the conviction, and I know everyone who's paying closely attention to these critters and the communities that are affected by it. We just don't have much time. With regards to resources online or on our website, I just encourage people to visit wildsalmon.org, www.wildsalmon.org. There are links from our homepage to a resource page for the DEIS comment period. We've got an action alert page that can connect you directly with our Northwest elected officials, phone numbers, addresses. There's just alerts that you can put your name in quickly and deliver messages to them. And then, you know, we encourage you to sign up for our newsletters and action alert system. And we'll be back in touch and providing opportunities for further engagement and for how people can help. Now, needless to say, you know, gatherings, events, speaker series, different sorts of things like that are all on hold for the foreseeable future. But we're certainly active in keeping our website and our supporters updated with developments and ways they can help.
And there's I just have to agree that the Save Our Wild Salmon website is a great one-stop shop if you are looking for information on this issue of orcas, salmon, dams, energy. There's lots of information there and plenty of interesting rabbit holes to go down if you wanted, but there's also quick ways to take action and just make your voice heard. And that's why, as a commercial fisherman, I do support Save Our Wild Salmon, because I think the work is pretty fair and just and considers all the users and stakeholders. I think it's a good resource.
Well, thank you very much. I will include those links also on our website with this podcast episode. And I want to thank you both so much for coming on and chatting with me today. I just really appreciate your thoughts, and I'd love to have you both on again another time as we get further down the road with this issue.
Thank you, Whitney.
Yeah, thank you, Whitney. It's been a pleasure chatting with you both.
Thank you all so much for listening today. As always, if you want to hear more podcasts, go up to whalescout.org. You will find all of our podcasts dating back to 2014. A lot of them are great, no matter when they were recorded, our evergreen episodes. And if you want these podcasts sent directly to your phone, subscribe on iTunes, and you can listen wherever you go, including at home. Thank you so much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.